Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
Crikey, everyone. How about all that? A remarkable quarterfinals weekend in France. Two absolute classic games in Paris, which we'll remember forever, I think. And some other matches were played in Marseille as well, apparently. We were all virtual for this episode this week, but you're once more joined by myself, Ben Coles. I'm here with Charlie Morgan. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Ben.
And also with Charles Richardson. Salut, Charles.
Salut, bonjour, tout le monde.
Charlie and I have popped back to London for a couple of days, and Charles, we've left you in Paris. Just wondered what the mood is like as they try and process what happened on Sunday night.
Well, yeah, the cold has crept into Paris, but it's nothing in comparison to the frost that hit on Sunday night at the Stade de France when France crashed out. Yeah, just stunned. I think everyone was stunned. I think France as a nation has been stunned. They can't believe it. Just complete dejection, desolation. I've never seen Antoine Dupont like that in a post-match press conference before. And
What was the tone of him calling out Ben O'Keefe? Because I found that, because I've never seen him, even on the pitch, I've hardly seen him break into anything quizzical even.
It was surprisingly spicy, I would say. The first question or the second question that he was asked, it happened very early on in the press conference. A French reporter asked him what he thought of Ben O'Keefe's performance. And Dupont immediately just went back and said, well, what did you think of Ben O'Keefe's performance? That was his retort, his immediate retort. And then he just completely went off on one, and I've never seen him like that before. Said that Ben O'Keefe wasn't at the required level for a game of such magnitude. And yeah, I've never heard him be so animated about anything, actually, let alone an official.
You raised a great point, Charles, when we were chatting about it afterwards, that basically every single ruck in that final passage of play, he would sort of just stand there with his hands on his hips and look at O'Keefe like, can you give me a penalty here? You're going to allow this to
really
happen? Like, really? That, it was such an interesting theme. We'll dive more into that game and the others as well. Just a quick note for you that while we might not be together right now, keep your eyes peeled for a potential special episode later this week when we're all in Paris for what is going to be the first time this tournament that all three of us have been in the same city, I want to say, for one game.
That's correct.
Charles, a nice, easy layup for you. To start off, give me a highlight for the weekend. And you get to go first. That's very lucky.
I think, although it sounds a little bit sort of brutal in a losing cause, I think the performance of Petr Movaka, the French hooker, was probably my highlight of the weekend. I think it was the best individual performance of the weekend alongside Ardie Surveyor and Sam Kane for New Zealand. I thought he was magnificent. He's not even first choice for them. You know, Julien Marchand, he would usually be the starting hooker. As I rate my player ratings, he might well be first choice now, because that was some display for a hooker.
Charlie, what about you?
He got 10 out of 10 from you, didn't he, Charles?
He did. He did get 10 out of 10. Fair. I thought it was absolutely magnificent.
Mine was Damien Willemse calling for a scrum from a mark, because I just thought that was really cool, really emblematic of how crafty and how much swagger there is about this Springbok side, maybe particularly their coaching team, and how they managed to navigate that game was pretty special. I think Razzy Erasmus has been on record since I wrote a piece that's on our website about that moment, saying that it wasn't performative, which I disagree with a bit, but it was more about engaging France in a scrummaging battle, and actually I think even more cleverly to sort of make them think about their own kicking game and shortening up their kicking game, because long kicking has been such a foundation of their success over this past World Cup cycle. So I just thought it was really cool on so many levels.
Yeah, I think that was. I think there's an argument to say that that's where the game was won almost. You know, that moment, that felt like such a turning point. Didn't necessarily feel it so much at the time, but looking back in terms of how South Africa strangled that second half, I think the French team have become synonymous with being bold and daring and audacious. And actually, the most audacious moment of the entire match was at the hands of the Springboks. So I think that was. Yeah, a monstrous moment.
It sort of meant everything, and it meant nothing, because I agree with all of those things as far as a statement being made, Charles. But and they won a penalty, which sort of doubled down on how much of a flex it was. But then they kicked for touch, and they didn't make touch, did they? So it sort of meant nothing. But again, yeah, statement of it.
But it was a mentality thing, and the repercussions of. What that had done in the minds of both referee and France, sort of for the rest of the game, because from then in on as well, I think that was the first scrum penalty, and from there it became a very one sided area of the game. I would say
a half highlight for me was watching Charles give out a 10 out of 10 in his player ratings, because I was just like, is he going to do it? And then he did, and I was absolutely astounded. I will go with something from Ireland New Zealand, just the end of Ireland New Zealand, because. Pulling back the curtain slightly, we were on player ratings and we filed them before the final whistle because of, you know, got to get the paper away. So I actually got to watch the final few minutes. I've never felt my sort of heart going as much a final like bit of players, those 37 phases. No real affiliation to either side. I was just kind of so wrapped up in the moment. And I think everyone else was, because everyone was sort of watching and it was loud, but everyone was hushed at the same time. It was just... extraordinary theatre, and yeah, let's talk more about it in a bit, but just before we finish this section, England are the only Northern Hemisphere team left. Charlie, discuss, just like we called it all along.
Yeah, wild. I mean that doesn't surprise me hugely just given the draw, but I'd shout out to Michael Checker for giving a really interesting take on the draw, which was just that they're all encompassing in these tournaments, and you find out about them years to go, and you just tailor everything with that draw in mind when you peak. And he used an example from the England game, because Argentina were horrible, as we've discussed in that England game. But he said, well, yeah, our prep was in no way were we going to peak for that. We had a light preparation. We didn't play many games. They had the Rugby Championship, and then if you remember, they didn't have another kind of big international. They played Spain and won that very easily. Actually picked up an injury, so it would have been a sort of, I imagine, fairly underwhelming run out. And he just said, we knew that game would be rough against England because we had a lot of guys playing in the World Cup for the first time. England have gone the other way. They've gone for experience. And then from there, Argentina are built and built and built, and now they've got a shot at reaching a final for the first time in history. So to go back on England, not hugely surprised given the draw. And I think it was always going to get to this point where they've given Steve Borthwick and his coaching team a chance to really work out a game plan for a one-off big game. And we know that that's what he enjoys doing. So very interesting times ahead as well.
We've basically had the draw reversed, haven't we? I mean, the upshot may well... have been the same. It might still have always been a New Zealand-South Africa final. We'll never know. I mean, it might not be a New Zealand-South Africa final, but that's the way that the wind's blowing. I think we'd all agree. But I think we've got sort of the quarterfinals after the semis almost. That's certainly how it feels in terms of the vibe of the tournament now. I think there was much more anticipation last week ahead of those four matches than there is and has been so far this week. I mean, I know we're only early in the week, but I just can't see it hitting the same heights as it did last week in terms of anticipation, just because on paper there are two such clear favourites.
Let's dive in to start with, Charlie, after a little break, to hear what you made of England's win over Fiji to get them into the semi-finals. Right, Charlie, England are in the final four, and there seemed to be a consensus that up until like the last 20 minutes or so, this was their best performance at this World Cup. What did you make of it?
Yeah, very good twice, actually, in two different ways because of what you're talking about there. Going 24-10 up, they were really good. They kind of didn't give Fiji oxygen in the areas that Fiji are really good at. I thought a really, really impressive facet of their game, which kind of helped them get over the line again at the end, was they Lavani Bhatia swoops to win a jackal turnover with 82 seconds on the clock from in the middle of an England attack that actually looks quite sharp. Then Hobozi gets one out wide after England go quick from a free kick, trying to throw something a little bit different at Fiji. And from there on, there was a tangible sense that was sort of personified or kind of came through most clearly in the performances of England's back five forwards of, right, Mathieu Reynal is letting quite a lot go here. We've got to be just as aggressive ourselves. And that, to me, just shows a serious amount of progress, because how often, when England lose big games or games at all, it's often been because they've been quite tentative at the breakdown, or they've become set, they've been sort of bullied a bit in that area, or outmaneuvered, however you want to put it, and they've just got on the wrong side of the referee. And this was them taking that into their own hands. Laws was fantastic, Itoje was fantastic, and I know you've written about the refereeing decisions, Colsey, and how Wasei and Isolevu was pretty gutted at the end of the game. But I genuinely think that was a seriously frenetic breakdown battle, and he was reasonably even. You know, Fiji did get some calls their way over the course of it, but just how aggressive England were there was really, really good. And as I say, they won it twice. They got to 24-10 up, had a bit of a stumble, lost all momentum when Batitu went over. It was looking pretty hairy for them, but then they righted themselves again and came through. And that's what you just have to do in knockout games. Often, as players will say, you have to win it more than once.
Yeah, I'm not giving them enough credit, really, with that introduction. They did actually do very well in the final 10 minutes to regather their composure and to kind of settle things down. The drop goal was actually very well executed. I think we were watching just outside the Stade de France, weren't we, Charles, and in a room full of Saffers and a few French people. And when Farrell kicked the drop goal, I think everybody was sort of like, oh, yeah, that, you know, it's a very sensible decision.
It was a ripple of applause.
It was really funny being in the ground. So Farrell got booed during the warm up, as he's done ridiculously over the last couple of months or so. And I think his first couple of shots at goal, when he sort of opted to shoot to go for goal, got a smattering of boos. And as the game went on, every time he pointed for post, there was sort of more and more positive reaction, and it was sort of like, yeah, it was like people there were sort of realizing, and some of the boos will have come from neutrals and Fiji fans, I'm sure, but it was like the England fans there were realizing, yeah, this is actually our best shot of winning games at this World Cup. And it was him taking command of that. The drop goal, I don't know about you, live, I was totally foxed by it. I thought they were going to continue going around the corner, and I hadn't actually seen Farrell go into the pocket. So at one point, when sort of Danny Kerr swiveled and passed it back, I thought, that's going to no one. Oh, no, it's going to Owen Farrell. It was really, but it was quite sharp, wasn't it? And quite clinical.
They completely did you, hook, line and sinker.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that was the first drop goal attempt from England, wasn't it? Since the Argentina game, is that right? And I think we're going to have to see it again this Sunday. I think it needs to revert to their Argentina best, I think, if we're going to see an upset, don't they?
Is that basically every time they get, 40 metres out, someone needs to be in the pocket? Because on a serious point regarding that, because that was the one thing. We'll talk more about France later. That was the one thing when France were 25-19 up and they were pressing in the second half, where I just thought, somebody please take 3 points somehow. Like someone knock over drop goal. Somebody like win a penalty and kick three, just to get beyond a score of South Africa and France didn't. And look what happened.
I always think that that period, and it's always around or often around the sort of end of the third quarter into the fourth quarter, isn't it? And a team will be sort of either on the cusp of one score ahead or on the cusp of going 2 to 3 scores ahead. And England had it, they were 24-10 up. And there was a point where Farrell's long range shot dropped short. And he just thought, the firepower that Fiji have got, you want to be 3 scores ahead. You want to be 15 points or more ahead. And those are the times, and it's sometimes it must be very difficult for players to sort of take a step back from the moment that they're in. But those are the times when drop goals are sort of more valuable than ever. And that's what England did so well in that first game against Argentina, was just don't get bored with it. And there was a moment when England were 15-3 up, and Alex Mitchell sends a box kick out on the full, and then Tom Curry concedes a really needless breakdown penalty. Those are the areas where you just can't get bored in knockout games, but that's when the stress on you just hammering home that game plan relentlessly, that's when the kind of, I guess, the stress must feel at its highest. But no, absolutely, I totally agree with you, Colsey.
And I think that's going to be even more important this weekend, because from the way South Africa played against France, I mean, I know they'll change tack slightly and they'll have a bespoke plan for England, but they just fed off French errors, really. Honestly, France played all the rugby. I mean, you look at the defenders beaten. I think France are into the 40s. South Africa are around 12. France played all the rugby, but then South Africa knew and just stuck in the fight and were patient and patient and patient, waited for France to make a mistake. And South Africa capitalised. And that's what will happen this weekend, unless England are 100% accurate and whiter than white everywhere. And they just have to keep that concentration for a full 80 minutes. They have to.
This is a question sort of tied to those French errors in the kicking game, Charlie, in the way they went after Louis Bierbiari out on the wing. Will England keep Smith at 15 and move Stewart onto the wing to have a better kicking option, or are they almost too worried about being beaten for pace on the wing by Colby or Arenzi that you want to keep a Johnny May out there? How are they going to manage sort of being strong in the kicking game but having enough speed to cover those players?
I would say I never for a minute thought that Freddie Stewart being dropped from the Fiji game was the end of his tournament. Mm-hmm. If England continued to win, of course. I would reinstate him at fullback. I think Elliot Daly has sneakily defended quite well in this tournament. I think Johnny May's experience as far as positioning is quite important. And then one more, I think having those three centres, Marchetu, Lagi and Lawrence in the 23 is important. So for me, I think it comes down to Smith or Ford. But Stewart, they've gradually, slowly used, and a quite a good example was, I think, the first Wales warm-up game. They've used him as a, not just a sort of goalkeeper type fullback to sort of mop up high balls from opposition. They've used him on the front foot a bit more as well. And I think that's going to be key, just putting that heat aerially back on South Africa, because you're right, South Africa themselves used that fantastically against France, didn't they?
Charles, is it fair to say that Ben Earl has been England's best player at this World Cup with the performances he's actually now consistently putting in?
I think that's totally fair, and certainly when you add to that that he's basically playing out of position. I know he can play number 8, but that's not his full time position. You know, we see him more on the flank. I think he's certainly been. You know, he was excellent again against Fiji. One of England's best. And I don't think any of us would have necessarily had that at the start of the tournament as a prediction. And certainly not in the Six Nations, where he was dropped by Borthwick for which game was it? After the Scotland game, was it? Where he dropped him for the Wales game, is that right? He's been absolutely magnificent on the back row. Absolutely magnificent. And I would have started Billy Vunipola at the start of the tournament. I still think that potentially at his best when he's fully fit and firing, there's still a space for Billy Vunipola on that back row, just because of the the ball carrying ballast that he gives to England. But certainly at the minute, in terms of form, you can't look beyond Ben Earl at number eight. I just on the kicking point, I think something that's sort of slightly gets forgotten about is just how short Chesson Colby and Kurt Lorenzo are in comparison to Freddie Stewart and Johnny May and Elliot Daly. And that is somewhere where England could properly get into them, I think, on Sunday. And I mentioned it in a piece on the website about slightly clutching at straws, but where England could potentially harm South Africa. And I think Johnny May and Elliot Daly are both excellent in chasing, attacking box kicks and reclaiming the ball. We saw Johnny May do it brilliantly, ironically, in the loss to Fiji in the warm-ups. And I think with those two and Freddie Stewart, that's somewhere where England could really, you know, hurt the Springboks. And that's such a sort of easy territory wins and easy possession wins as well. And it's sort of, you know, it's going to be a game. It's going to be tight. It's going to be cagey. And it's going to be a game where these small wins could add up into something much bigger. I mean, we've just spoken about how South Africa calling a scrum from a mark felt like a turning point in a game. Well, there could be similar things that happen on Sunday.
And I just wondered, Charles, in terms of how, where that performance ranks as England's under Steve's, I think we're decided in saying that is the best performance thing that they've produced so far. They're going to go into this as underdogs, and we'll chat into it. We'll talk more previewy a bit later in the week. But I just think in terms of, there seems to be a real confidence to them and a real steeliness. And the quotes yesterday about Farrell and about Genge saying, everyone wants us to lose. Do you quite like the vibe that England are giving off at the moment?
Well, I certainly like the fact that they're not getting ahead of themselves. I think I don't think a team coached by Steve Borthwick will ever get ahead of itself, frankly. But I do think that there's no need for them this week to be particularly punchy in the press, I don't think, because, well, they might see it that they've got nothing to lose, but also at the same time, there's no need to poke the bear this week. Like, they're underdogs. They could definitely go in and surprise South Africa, sort of a bit under the radar, maybe, and just concentrate on themselves. A bit like England, New Zealand, that victory in 2019, where I think the playing fields were a little bit more level between England and New Zealand in 2019. But there was a sense of England sort of seemed very composed and concentrating on themselves and believing that they could pull off an upset without having to sort of get into the opposition too much or talk very much about sort of the wider picture. I don't think Ellis Genge is correct when he says that everyone hates them. I think that's a little bit strong. Hate is a very, very strong word. But I certainly do think they are underdogs this weekend, and maybe embracing that could work in their favour.
More preview chat to come later in the week, but we need to look back. And Charles, I know this will be hard, but we need to talk about France. So let's do that next. France and Africa on Sunday night. What an absolute pleasure to be there. To be honest, it was an absolute delight. One of the great games. Maybe the best first half of rugby I've ever seen, and I think a lot of people are in agreement about that. We had six tries in the first 30 minutes alone, and they were like two heavyweight boxers going at each other in just an amazing, amazing contest. Charles, how would you sum up the noise in the stadium when France got those first couple of tries through Surabaya and Peter Mavaka? It was unreal, wasn't it?
Absolutely incandescent. I mean, it was breathtaking stuff. It was breathless. The game was being played at such a pace. Little did we know, actually, at that time, that was France's purple patch, basically for the entire game. I know they scored more points, but that was where they had to hammer home that advantage. And were it not for a very, very dubious Eben Etzebeth knock backwards / knock forwards, they might have had an extra try and conversion. But the atmosphere was absolutely breathtaking, spine tingling. All those words that come out were all completely justified on Sunday night. A superb rendition of La Marseillaise, although all the anthems are still far too fast in terms of the renditions of the versions. So it gets all higgledy-piggledy across the stadium. But an absolutely phenomenal atmosphere. And the Springboks fans and the Springboks team played their part too. This was not just, obviously South Africa won, so it clearly wasn't just one-way traffic, one-sided. But even in terms of the vibe in the stadium, it was something real special.
Listeners, Charles has just pulled out like a presentation behind him showing how the Etzebeth contact was forward and the various angles and trigonometry involved. And it looks very detailed, Charles. I don't think it will change the outcome, sadly.
And don't get me started on the Colbert charge down.
Oh, no, that's honestly next on my list of things to talk about. So did you think he set off early? So one French journalist, I think it was Clément Mazzella, put out a video, which I guess came from TF1, which sort of showed the sort of split second where Colby started moving and Ramos kind of shuffled his feet or shoulders. And I thought it was too tight to rule out the conversion or to say the charge down was legal. Charles, what did you think?
No, I'd agree with you, Colsey. I'd agree with you. All I would say is... My annoyance was more, and frustration was more, with the fact that I don't think it was checked, or at least if it was very subtly checked in the background and we weren't made aware of it. That's like 100% in these matches, the sort of thing that the TMO should be checking. And if the TMO did check it, I agree that I don't think there was anything necessarily clear and obvious to overturn the decision. But if they didn't check it, then that's a problem, because that was such a big moment. Again, these small moments where at the time, I don't think you and I felt that it, you know, that it was that crucial. It felt sloppy from Ramos and superb from Colbe, but I didn't feel like it would decide the game. And in the end, it actually might have done. We'll never know, but it might have done.
No, I was going to agree. At the time, it sort of felt like a cool detail in a wild first half. But if you told me that those 2 points denied would be the difference between one of the teams going to the semi-finals, the consequences were enormous. Charlie, talk to me about what percentage of the hair on your body stood on end when you saw Damian Winter call for a mark and then say, yeah, we'll have a scrum in our own 22.
I think my hand did inadvertently go up to my mouth. I just thought it was, the swagger on it, the flex, it's sort of become a term used in cricket a lot, hasn't it? Alphaing someone. When you get somebody to give you throwdowns in the nets or something like that, or don't take your helmet off when you score 100. It was sort of, it's had that vibe to it. But yeah, just fantastic. It was just one of those of things, like the Etzebeth sort of bat backwards in inverted commas, and like the Colby charge down that you hardly ever see. You sort of know they're possible in rugby union. You know that you can do that. If you're absolutely nuts, you can call for a scrum from a mark. But actually to have it happen in a World Cup knockout game, and to have them all packed into that first half, as you say, incredible, really.
There have been charge down conversions, and you do see them.
Yeah.
Maybe like once a season, maybe.
Yeah.
And it's very rare at international level. But what I would say is I don't think I've ever seen a scrum call from a mark, ever in my entire life, I don't think.
I loved it.
I think you could do it on Jonah Lomu rugby, genuinely, because the options come up.
I think you're right.
The options come up and you could press to square
triangle,
or whatever, and go
triangle,
for a scrum.
Yeah.
Was it triangle? Sure. Charging down conversions. Do you remember, Pete, I think it was in a Barbarians game, was it Peter Stringer? James O'Connor was cooking. Was he cooking? He was kicking.
He was cooking.
He was kicking for Australia, and he had a bit of a shoulder shuffle, and Peter Stringer just started running and then picked up the ball because O'Connor hadn't moved since. Yeah, it was just before half time, but that's definitely a thing, and nobody knew what was going on then either.
We've had a charge down conversion recently, haven't we? Am I going mad? I feel like there's been one within the last...
one at the weekend.
No, as in before... I feel like we've had one within the last year. Am I just... Maybe it's some Premiership game that I've watched and it's stuck in my brain.
Shout out to Andrew Ford, who does these fantastic compilations on YouTube. I think he's got a compilation of charge down conversions, which is get onto that.
That's fast work. Fair play to him. It's not the first time we've said this, and it won't be the last. But I thought South Africa's use of their bench was particularly interesting, because you had Kolesyov on about 46 minutes for Dion Fury, I think, coming on, who is your kind of hybrid hooker back row. And then Libok and Reinach were off about the same time for De Klerk and Pollard. They'd gone back to a 5-3 split, and we're so obsessed with South Africa's power off the bench. We thought actually tactically bringing those players on, given where the game was poised at that time, was really interesting. And it worked, didn't it? Because, you know, it was nice because you had De Klerk and Pollard on to kind of see the game out, slash scrap you back into a lead.
Yeah, I mean, they were amazing. Just the energy that they brought. They completely outdid France's bench. I think France probably would regret going 6-2, maybe. I'm not really sure. But I mean, because Pfaff brought so much energy at the base and harried. Kocher-Smith also just absolutely superb. Erche Snyman just putting in shots. They were all absolutely awesome. To a man, beat up their French equivalents, who also came off the bench. The front row did a proper job at the scrum. You then had Reda Wardy, the French loose head, coming off the bench, and he was, you know, he was dynamic and he was busy, but ultimately he's the player who knocked the ball on at the end to give South Africa the win. So yeah, I mean, it was absolutely a feather in the cap for the Springboks over France.
Did you go to Afrikaans school yesterday after I left you in Paris? Because you've been working hard on your pronunciations, and I'm
following the Springboks this week, so I'm just getting in the.
You're just trying to make friends. You're just trying to get on side. Yeah. With the DuPont comments, we mentioned them earlier. I wonder how World Rugby will deal with that. Because it's just quite interesting, because it's DuPont, face of the tournament, sort of very openly criticising a referee as brazenly as we see coaches do, and then coaches get, you know, quite a word in the ear or punished for sort of referee criticism. I mean, they kind of, pardon me, feels like they kind of have to do something, don't they? And also, poor Ben O'Keefe. I mean, he had a day where, you know, every decision scrutinised, and he had to say hello to me and Charles and on Sunday morning when we walked past him leaving our hotel as well. Maybe that's what set off the chain of events. But on the more serious point, Charlie, what do you think they do?
Well, I don't know where does the sport go if the best... So Wayne Barnes refereeing South Africa is a thing now because of what happened in Marseille last November and the fallout from that after Razi Erasmus's sort of videos and the pile-on that ensued. Ben O'Keefe refereeing France when it happens again is going to be a thing because of how the high-profile nature and how he's been criticised. I just think every game, the margins are so small between the top sides in the world, and coaches are coaching players to take risks by being aggressive as possible on the floor and in the contact area. Whether you remember me helpfully informing Alad Walters how South Africa play, yes. But they go so hard. You know, they want to get in as many battles as possible, and officiating all of those battles absolutely correctly is impossible. So I think that there maintains this false impression of what is actually possible for referees, how good, in inverted commas, it is for them to be. DuPont should get at least a private talking to about it. He would have been seriously emotional, obviously, given just, you know, what France had built up and how much stock they'd put in this World Cup and in him personally. So emotions would have been high. But yeah, it's unacceptable, really.
Yeah.
Referees do have an impossible job, but I mean, are we not all in agreement that Mr. O'Keefe didn't have his finest evening? I'm not saying that it affected the result, and I'm not condoning Antoine Dupont's comments, because I don't think he was the reason that France lost, but I don't think necessarily Ben O'Keefe had his finest evening with the whistle.
Given it took me about 5 hours to pick through England Fiji yesterday, checking all the key penalties, if you now do it for France New Zealand and present me with the France Africa and present me with the evidence, then yeah.
What are the calls we're talking about? What are the calls we're talking about? The Etzebeth, just checking them.
I thought also just the breakdown was a mess, and he let both teams just get away with murder. Really, I thought that it was just a complete mess. The breakdown on numerous occasions. I thought that he didn't manage the tackler rolling away very well. He didn't manage that was the main one, to be honest. It was the tackler rolling away, and you could tell by the end how frustrated Antoine Dupont was with South Africa tacklers getting in the way of him wanting to play the ball quickly. They were rolling into him, but they were just on the right line every single time, whereby it wasn't completely obvious that they were infringing. And I think O'Keefe let them get away with it a little bit. Maybe it was a tactical, strategic masterclass, and they were gaming the system perfectly. And I don't doubt that, you know, that was part of it. But I think also he there was the pass from Faf de Klerk into the prone French player. I mean, I know
that's a penalty for me.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah. I think so too. I mean, I can't believe he let France get away with it. You know, yeah. As in every other day of the week, it's in the Prem, that's a penalty to the attacking team every day of the week. And I just think there was a lot of very strange decisions happening. Mm. I mean, we'll find out probably today, maybe tomorrow, whether he's got a semi-final. There's only one he can actually have. And it's England's, and we'll see what the powers that be made of his performance on Sunday night.
Before we think about refereeing appointments, we need to chat about the other quarterfinal on Saturday, and just what a belter that was. So let's do that now. I wonder, when we look back on the tournament, which actual game we will think was better out of Ireland, New Zealand and France Africa, because having been at both and having been so enamoured with the first half of France Africa, I am already kind of leaning towards Ireland New Zealand, just because it was extraordinary on so many levels. I would put it as New Zealand's best performance since, I thought it was better than the Ellis Park win last year, which was really good. Maybe that, and probably better than anything they produced at the Rugby World Cup in 2019. Like, I can remember being really impressed with how they played in that opening win over South Africa and sort of in the quarterfinal. But I would put it as their best win since the first test against the Lions in 2017. Would there be any quibbling there from either of you if I said that?
That's a great shout, the 2017 first test, because that was also a bit of a tactical curveball, wasn't it? They sort of narrowed things up and just pumped the lines through the middle, which wasn't really expected. Got super quick ball. Aaron Smith was amazing. They were very good. They showed a little flashes of how clinical and how clever they were off the back of kicks against South Africa in the Rugby Championship in Auckland. But I think as far as a sustained effort on both sides of the ball as well, I've seen Bernard Jackman make the point that a lot of teams have gone after Ireland during this winning run in one specific area and maybe got a little bit of pay. New Zealand went after them in a kind of load of different ways. So with a short kicking game, with the attack off the back of that, and then also just relentlessly a defensive breakdown, which really rattled Ireland. And normally if a team does that for a little bit against Ireland, then Ireland are good enough to make their attack click and get a couple of tries to give them breathing space when there are lapses from the defence. But it was just a kind of all-out 80-minute effort from New Zealand in defence, which was, phenomenal.
Charles, what a statement performance from Sam Kane, the All Blacks captain, whose kind of selection had been discussed in the build-up. Would they go with the more athletic Dalton Papali'i? Would they go with Kane for his kind of his work rate and his graft? And he more than showed why he was the right selection at Openside Flanker, didn't he?
Oh yeah, egg on my face totally, because I think on the pod either last week or the week before I was suggesting that Dalton Papali'i should start at seven and they should have Kane on the bench and make Ardy captain. And maybe he heard me, he probably didn't. And proved me completely wrong on Saturday night, because he was the best player on the park, I thought. Absolutely unbelievable, some of the shots he was putting in. There was one on Doris in the first half. There was that one where he came flying across to chop Keenan in the second half that stopped you in their tracks. And he was just a menace at the breakdown. Him and Ardie Savea just dovetailed beautifully in defence and really, really disrupted Ireland, really rattled Ireland. And then you've got the sort of the power and the dynamism of Shannon Frizzell at six. And if they carry on playing like that, then it's going to take a really good team, given how crucial the back row unit is in modern rugby. It's going to take a really, really good team to stop them from lifting another world title.
Foster was quite interesting afterwards, wasn't he? Because he sort of suggested that Frizzell had been good, but maybe not quite playing to his full limit. So it does make you, it makes you interested to see what you can get from, if you have Frizzell at playing at his maximum with Kane playing like that with Andy Surveyor just being, he's just so much fun to watch on both sides of the ball with the turnovers he makes and the carries he can offer out wide in those wider channels. I was so impressed. I went back through the tape on Sunday morning to look at what Kane had done. And you're right, Charles, they do dovetail so well, because so often it would be one would be the tackler and then one would be ready to jackal. And you had situations where Ian Henderson sort of carried into the two of them and poor Hugo Keenan was trying to get like Kane and Surveyor off a ruck. And I just thought, oh, bless you. Like you're never going to be able to sort of remove those players in that situation. No, I was impressed. He had the most tackles, 22 tackles. Maybe not the most important intervention early game, because that belongs to Geordie Barrett stopping him all. Charlie, I mean, he's such a big figure, physical presence now used in that 12. But that seems as though they'd really practiced that with him in that role, trying to get under those mauls, and it worked perfectly.
Yeah, Mwanga was in there as well, wasn't he? And a huge, huge, huge moment. And that's, yeah, I've seen the whole did Ireland choke sort of theme bandied around. I don't think they were at their best. And New Zealand exploited that, but that just shows how small the margins were, right? It was actually critical, I thought, looking back, that it felt important at the time that New Zealand, because they were cagey at the start, but how they sort of escaped their half and then got 3-0 up and then went 6, went 13 with that fantastic try from Lestafaye and Ngunuku. That felt very, to get that buffer against a team that hasn't, let alone winning a quarterfinal. They haven't led in a World Cup quarterfinal since 1995. That's a heavy psychological burden. And then the sort of little errors that came later. So, for instance, Connor Murray's obstruction penalty, Caelan Doris dropping a dropout mad for
the Sexton penalty miss.
And then the Sexton penalty was the other one I'm thinking of. Those errors looked like a bit of jitters settling in. Having said that, for Ireland to work their way up the pitch brilliantly and have that faith in their phase play to go 37 phases, and they so nearly did it. I genuinely, as I was like you, Coles, you mentioned your heart rate at the start. God knows what my God knows what mine was. It was rattling around for sure.
It was. I was just thinking about the jitters and also that crazy Gibson pass sort of looking to the wing that Aaron Smith picked off as well, which could have gone the other way if it hadn't been for a very timely tap tackle. We'll talk more about Sexton in just a sec, but his quote afterwards I thought was really interesting about the sort of tone of the game and how the All Blacks tries had sort of come as like sucker punches essentially, because it had been when Ireland had sort of just scored or they just got a bit of momentum, and the whole game felt like Ireland were just going to get there eventually and get ahead because they weren't playing badly, just having defensive lapses, and it never happened. I was fascinated by how we never got there. Charles, how much do you reckon the Joe Schmidt element was a factor in it? The Will Jordan try was very well worked and sort of had an air of it, a Schmidt sort of strike play with Jordan on the inside. How much did his influence count in this game, do you think?
I think highly. I mean, also, as Charlie's touched on, I think those chips over the top were clearly the short chips from Beauden Barrett and from Richie Mwanga were clearly a very sort of deliberate tactic to try and get in behind Ireland, to try and thwart that defensive line speed. And they worked. They got in behind. They gave them front foot ball. It formed a part of that very positive first half for them. And then in the second half, they stung them with that. About from halfway that try from the Will Jordan try where Mwanga, and I think that had been building from those chips over the top. I think Josh van der Vlier, who's defending against Moanga, was caught in two minds because he was wary of Moanga with ball in two hands, with Jordan on his inside shoulder, that he might chip over again. So I think he was just caught in three minds as to, is Moanga going to chip over here for Jordan to chase? Is he going to hit Jordan on his inside? And in the end, he did neither, and he sort of dummied with ball in two hands and went himself. And it wasn't a sort of missed tackle, as it were, from poor technique. It was that I don't think he quite read, van der Vlier didn't read what was happening because of the earlier work that they'd done with the chips over the top and that doubt, that seed of doubt that they'd planted in the Irish minds. And from that, it was a marvellous, marvellous score. My favourite try of the game. And I mean, it had Joe Schmidt's fingerprints all over it, didn't it, in terms of the tactics from where it came from, the strategy. And him knowing this Irish team not quite as well as some people have suggested, I don't think, because obviously it's developed and metamorphosed a lot. But his knowledge of how they play and how they want to play, and his knowledge of how Andy Farrell coaches, because he was there with him with Ireland, certainly would have played a massive part in that victory.
If we get a New Zealand South Africa final, don't play the game because you don't need to. Just do a Colby Will Jordan sprint across the field and see who wins and decide it that way. Jordan is fast. And Colby going like poor Damian Penno trying to turn to catch Colby for the Jesse Creel kick through Colby's try. I just looked at Penno and was like, you're quick and you are nowhere near what Colby's doing.
It's the acceleration, isn't it? It's the turn of pace.
Yeah, just extraordinary. Just to finish up the game, quickly on the All Blacks and then on Ireland. On the All Blacks, Charlie, have they... I wonder if they can replicate the intensity of that performance one week on, because they sort of fixed everything that went wrong against France in the opener, and that they had the fast start, except this time they kept going, whereas this time, you know, they had the fast start and they were able to stay ahead and keep finding ways to score. Is it? Can you replicate that again a week on in a semi-final?
I'd be incredibly impressed for a few reasons. I've just checked, and you can get 1-4 on a New Zealand South Africa final. An England Argentina final is 40-1, which is quite something. It's a really interesting question, because the All Blacks were obviously involved in a semi-final in 2019 against England, and England produced a quite remarkable performance against them, similar in as far as accuracy and intensity as New Zealand have just delivered against Ireland. And Steve Hansen tells a story of being in the sheds with England afterwards and saying, make sure that's not your final. And New Zealand clearly won't need that. New Zealand clearly won't need that lesson, because they've been around the block before and they've delivered fantastic performances in knockouts before. If, at the quarterfinal stage, you even think about how they pumped France in 2015. But I just, to get to those levels again, as far as the, as I say, the output over the 80 minutes, they didn't commit. Ireland didn't have one scrum put in. They did not have one scrum put in the game, because the New Zealand handling was so slick, and they knew exactly when to sort of, you know, give up and kick the ball. That is incredible accuracy that is just so difficult to replicate on a kind of technical level, never mind the kind of emotional heights that they've got to reach again to deliver what they delivered in defence and as far as a commitment side. So difficult.
Yeah. And Charles, one for you. You've written about the kind of the rebuild ahead of Ireland now, after yet another quarterfinal exit, because of the quality of the team this time, you can almost barely believe it. Just give me a summary of who is basically going sort of straight away that we know. I mean, Keith Earls and Johnny Sexton are retiring, but who else is probably going to be out of the picture by the time we get to Australia in 2027?
Well, I mean, that's all we know for certain. Peter Omani, after the game, was a husk of a man, to be honest, and was asked about his future, and he just said he didn't know. I think there's probably about a third. Obviously, we don't know for certain, and players are playing longer and longer, and you look at Sexton at 38, although I do think he's the anomaly and not the rule. I reckon about a third of that starting 15 will make, fitness permitting and form permitting, Australia 2027, which means that there's two-thirds of that starting 15 up for grabs. It might be that the players who are currently there make it, and they if they sort of have longer careers, but they might need, you know, to tap into this fantastic talent conveyor belt that they've got in Ireland, and you know they're in such good shape as a rugby nation at the minute. We've written a lot about that. There's a lot about that on the Telegraph website. Just like France, they're the two nations who are nailing it domestically at the minute and are sort of streamlining their domestic scene to ensure that there's a lot of success at international level. And while they have both lost quarterfinals, so there has still been a lot of success at international level. And the future's very bright. You know, they were the two sides in the under-20s final this year. If there is an Irish rebuild, I don't think it will be a particularly arduous task. And they'll be back. They'll be back. I can't see them. I mean, I wouldn't put any money on it just because of the history of it. But I would be very, very surprised if they weren't semi-finalists in 2027.
Mm. Two final points on Ireland. What an amazing tournament Bundiaki's had. Just think he's been utterly outstanding. Talk about moments in the France and Africa game where you kind of, you were out your seat and going, whoa, like Bundiaki's try, not on... on Saturday night when he started stepping inside, I just thought, wow, that is a player who is both very talented, but is just oozing confidence and form and sort of belief in himself and what he can do. I just thought that was wonderful. And I really hope it's hard because, you know, he's out in a quarterfinal with Ireland, but I really hope he's in the player of the tournament chat when we finish. And the final word has to go to Johnny Sexton. The press conference afterwards, we were both in there, Charles, about two rows from the front where Andy Farrell and Johnny Sexton were, and Sexton was very kind of red-eyed and sort of wondered actually if he was going to go at one point after the first question. Shout out to his son, excellent kind of clip on social media saying he's still the best dad. I think that got everybody suddenly a massive amount of onions in every single living room in Ireland and everywhere else being chopped. But yeah, Charles, watching Sexton in that moment, that was pretty tough, wasn't it? And seeing him sort of have to go through that.
Yeah, you felt that, you know, the heart bled for him. If DuPont was a picture that the following evening and obviously looked completely broken, but Sexton took it up quite a few notches. He looked completely broken and utterly demoralized and dispirited, and it wasn't how he wanted to go out. It wasn't how he deserved to go out necessarily. He gave everything on the night, and it didn't go their way, and they lost to one of the great World Cup performances. And sometimes that happens.
Yeah, that was hard. That was hard to see. Hard for Ireland. Certainly felt for them going out. They won't be in the semi-finals, but one other team out of Wales and Argentina will be. Let's talk about that game next. Right, to wrap up the semi-finals, it's Argentina. It's Michael Checky's Argentina. It's two teams from Pool D in the semi-finals. Pool D.
The great Pool.
That Pool D. The Pool D where we must have said about 2 weeks ago, comfortably the worst pool in the competition, and it's not even close. Charlie, talk to me about Argentina, how they got past Wales. And also afterwards, when chatting to players and coaches, what did you sort of gauge of their mood ahead of getting to the final four?
First of all, Paul D, I think I called the worst ever in tournament history, which is quite punchy because it's now got two semi-finalists. But Argentina was so bad that they should have been disqualified for how bad they were against England. they were just shocking, weren't they? We said at the time that was just that was an all-time implosion. So fair play. But no, I said earlier in the pod, I was just really... the question was, I think, in the presser to Checker, tell us about this turnaround. And he said, well, there hasn't been a turnaround. There's just been a gradual improvement. And if you remember, they had that week off, didn't they, after that England game. So they just timed. They've done a classic thing where I was dubious about people calling them a tournament team because they weren't very good in 2019 either. Mm-hmm. But they've shown they've got an older profile probably this year, and but with players that haven't played So those players became more comfortable in, and the sort of the term Checker used for to describe the England game was it was a game where our players could understand what knockout rugby was without the danger of being knocked out, which was kind of, I think I've kind of got what he was saying. Afterwards from the players, Colsey, sort of a bit of defiance, a bit of nobody believes in us, which as we know is really a really kind of a really powerful thing.
I was going to say we've heard that before.
Yeah. The Pool D underdogs just rolling on with that message. Moroney, I spoke to Matthias Moroney, who was actually said, "Did you feel like you've got nothing to lose?" And he said, "No, we feel like we really want to get to a first final in Argentina history." And he said, "We fight for every moment," which Julian Montoya's, that's his, you know, he's kind of lived and breathed that as their captain. And that's what they did. They steadily overhauled Wales. I thought Wales should have been out of sight in the first half hour. But they left the door open and Argentina were good enough to get back in it.
I mean, in the end, wasn't it the most comfortable and convincing of the quarterfinal? I mean, I don't think Argentina would necessarily describe it as comfortable, but I think as a neutral, do we think it was most convincing of the four victories? I think, which is very surprising from where it was at halftime.
Wales were still in it until the interception, and it was. I'm a terrible judge for this. Games I'm at, I think I just get so caught up in. I thought the first half of Wales Argentina was awesome. It was really sort of cut and thrust stuff. Obviously, there were mistakes, and clearly there were two sides that aren't probably as good overall as the sides on the other side of the draw. But it was really interesting, and Wales. The pass from Jack Morgan seemed to sort of slow down time to step. I think it was Cabelli on the left edge, and he went through and Gareth Davis running a trademark support line spills that pass, which is a jarring moment because it doesn't. I watched it back and it doesn't look like it on the telly pictures, but he's in so much space when he does that. Then when George North goes through on the other side and throws a pass to Adams that's dropped, Gareth Davis is there again. So that's a 7-point spill as well. And at that stage, and with the line out errors as well that Wales had, they should have been further ahead than 10-0. And then for it to be 10-6 at half time was nuts, really. Warren Gatland was he volunteered the referee change, poor Jacko Piper, as a reason, but I think privately he'll be probably looking. He'd do well to sort of look a little bit in the mirror at how those chances were missed and how Wales just failed to sort of make that ascendancy pay.
Did he blame the sort of refereeing and the officiating, or did he blame the disruption caused by the change? Right,
the disruption caused by the change. And I asked him to elaborate and just said, look, how disruptive is that when you've when you have prepared all week for all sorts of things, because we know that people are thinking about not just referees' interpretations over breakdown and everything like that, it's stuff like that, how the cadence with which they're calling in scrums, it's so, the detail is incredible. You remember last tournament, South Africa knew that Jerome Garces liked being complimented on his physical appearance. Yeah. You know, those are the things people are thinking about. So it can be quite disruptive. However, you know, the same thing happened to Argentina, and they by the end they were comfortably on top as far as the breakdown, which obviously goes a long way to deciding these games, and they just adapted to what was real chaos just that bit better.
And just to finish this section, you mentioned Dan Biggar, a fantastic Wales career. I think he's one of those players who we will look back on him in maybe a few years time and he'll be appreciated a lot more for what he's done for Wales. I know he can rile a lot of people up, as in who aren't supporting Wales with how he plays, but I think he's so important from a perspective of what he offers in terms of leadership and also creativity. I don't feel like he gets enough praise for that. And I think Wales will really miss the kind of the leadership and the passion that he's brought to that number 10 jersey.
He was always damned with faint praise a bit. I remember Chris Boyd, his head coach at Northampton, or director of rugby at Northampton, whenever he'd play well for Saints, people had asked Boyd about how good Biggar had been, and he'd always say, he's the best in the world at what he does. And you're like, right, okay. So you're sort of admitting that he's got these limitations. And yeah, and I just love players of any sport like that who maybe have things that they can't do, but make the absolute most of the things they can do. And Dan Biggar's certainly been one of those guys. Fantastic to talk to as a journalist too, which always kind of bumps him up the rankings, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does.
But no, has worn his heart on his sleeve, and an absolute fantastic servant.
He's a ferocious competitor. You'd want him on your side. And a supreme individual rugby player, I would say, on an individual level. And that's not to take anything away from him. I just think that the things that have made him great are sort of embracing that individuality. I don't necessarily think that he was somebody who had the keys to completely unlocking a full back line necessarily and working in a very fluent midfield. But then he brought strengths in other areas. You know, he would a clutch goal kicker. He was there for the big moments when you needed him. And I think Wales will certainly miss that aspect a lot. And that leadership and everything that comes with that, almost the intangible stuff.
Yeah, they certainly will. Sexton going, Biggar going, two fantastic tens who've achieved great success for their countries. Right, let's finish up by having some of your questions. Okay, a couple of questions to finish up today. We've had one from Progressive Rugby, the welfare group, who've asked about Freddie Stewart, how he sort of started all the pre-warm-up games. He started loads of matches, and now he was axed on the team against Fiji on Sunday. Charlie, we touched on this earlier. You sort of said this tournament's not over. It wasn't really about workload, was it? It was about tactics, and we're expecting him to be back in the side probably on the weekend.
Yeah, certainly right in the mix. We just know Freddie Stewart will know Steve Borthwick's methods better than most players in that squad. He tailors game plans to opponents and he tailors selections to opponents. They're all big calls at this stage, obviously, and they're going to be made across all four teams. As you mentioned there, Argentina at fly half, what do they do? It never seemed like a permanent, never seemed like a big indictment of how Stewart has been playing necessarily, just more of a reflection of what he wanted for the Fiji game. The workload question is, I don't think that was a factor in their thinking. He did play all of the warm-up games. Maybe that was a bit of a double bluff going on as far as how they were then going to bring through Marcus Smith as an option there. But he did miss the Chile game, didn't he? He wasn't in the 23 at all. And then they had another week off. Oh, sorry, they had a week off after that game, didn't they? So I would say it wasn't to do with workload at all. We don't know about, it's kind of dangerous to cast aspersions on how teams are managing workload, but it certainly doesn't seem to have been a problem.
It's definitely the tactical trend that I didn't see coming. Smith at fullback and Stewart out at 23, given how much we sort of talked about Stewart last year. And just our other question from Dan, talking about just how much England's kind of play really hinges on scrum half and that South Africa are likely to target them. Charles, who would you start at scrum half? It's been Alex Mitchell now for a few weeks, but Danny Kerr's looked sharp, hasn't he, when he's come on?
Yeah, but I mean, I'd keep it the same. You know, we talk about starters and finishers and it being an 80-minute match and different roles for different players in the same position who are playing at different periods of the game. I'd keep Alex Mitchell on for 60 or so minutes, 55, 60 minutes, and then bring Danny Kerr on against some slightly more tired legs and when the game's broken up a little bit more and to add a little bit more zip, maybe, and a bit more of a threat around the fringes and to put in those lovely attacking kicks, those lovely dinks that he's been putting in. And yeah, I think they've got the balance right at the minute. I think there's always a temptation with scrum halves. We've said this before on the pod. I think there's always a temptation with scrum halves when the replacement comes on and shines against tired legs. And we all sort of go, he should be starting because he's come on and he's running rings around them in the 70th minute, 75th minute. But the incumbent, the starting scrum half, wasn't able to do that. And the caveat is always because, you know, that's at the start of the match against fresh legs when they're just trying to break the opposition down, work them out a little bit. I think they've got the balance right. I'd stick with Alex Mitchell. I think they're dovetailing really nicely. I'd stick with Alex Mitchell and bring Kerr on in the second half.
Do not rule out Ben Young starting. That's all I'll say. Hasn't had a start this tournament, I don't think. Came on, was very good against Argentina, came on against Chile. That is the sort of curveball that I think Steve Borthwick is capable of throwing. He's got to think about how aggressive Faf de Klerk or Reinacher will be around the ruck defensively, and they just might want to go Youngs and then Kerr. Don't know for sure, but I can feel it in my bones.
We do like a spicy semi-final curveball. Yeah, that sounds possible. Right, that's it for today. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Charles. And I'll see you both again later in the week when we have our little special bonus episode from Paris with the three of us previewing how England are going to get on against South Africa and also a bit on New Zealand, Argentina as well. Can't believe we're in the semi-final week. Until then, you can keep up with loads of content on the Telegraph Rugby website from all of us and all of our writers and also in the newspaper. So please have a look out. You're bound to find something you like as we build up to two massive games this weekend. But until then, from all three of us, thanks and goodbye. We'll see you in Paris.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.